Welcome to Revealing Men, conversations that pull back the curtain, revealing the inner lives of men. I'm Randy Flood, psychotherapist and director of the Men's Resource Center of West Michigan. I'd like to welcome Anthony Williams Jr. to the Revealing Men's podcast. Anthony is a results-oriented student affairs professional at Grand Valley. He and I met, it's been a few years back, and I did a presentation there to your staff about masculinity or something. And so welcome, Anthony.
Well, thank you, Randy. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. So he's a kind of results-oriented student affairs professional, and he specializes in looking at conflict resolution, alternative dispute resolution, as well as social justice education and restorative practices facilitation. Anthony currently serves as an associate dean of students at Grand Valley State University here in Allendale, and we've got downtown campus as well, where he oversees the day-to-day operations within the dean of students' offices, supervises the Office of Conduct and Conflict Resolution, and is responsible for institutional and divisional downtown initiatives, as well as divisional diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. He's currently, I don't know where he finds the time, but he's currently working on his PhD in urban higher education from Jackson State University. Anthony is very involved in several professional and social organizations, such as the Student Conduct Administration, the 100 Black Men of America Incorporated, and on a personal level, Anthony is happily married, he added that, happily married at this point anyway, we sure are going to continue, to Grace and Williams, and together, and they have two dogs, Kobe and Kingston.
Yep, we had a miniature Doberman, he just turned 11 years old, and we have a standard Doberman, he just turned 3.
So, wow.
We have fur babies.
Yeah. So welcome. I was talking to Anthony to have a conversation. You and I worked together on a collegial level, and that's how we got to know each other. You know, you also participate in the Title IX out at Grand Valley, and sometimes you refer young men who get into problems at school, some misconduct, and then you send them to me for risk assessments and some therapy. And so one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is just your experience on campus. I mean, I'm sure COVID has changed a lot of things doing virtual, but back in the day when they were on campus, what are some of the typical problems you see in some of the young men that come on campus that, you know, that get them into some kind of trouble that you end up getting involved with?
Yeah, so you mentioned Title IX. We actually don't have a ton of Title IX cases every year.
Okay.
Of course, we investigate a lot of cases, and that's a separate office from the office that I serve in. We have a Title IX investigator and a deputy Title IX investigator who they supervise and train a team to investigate any allegation of sexual misconduct or gender-based harassment that falls under Title IX and under our own, you know, Grand Valley policies. We have two separate policies for that now, based on the Office of Civil Rights new regulations. However, just general misconduct, you know, number one on Grand Valley's campus is no surprise, alcohol, underage alcohol consumption, which then leads to, you know, other violations such as, you know, disruptive behavior, violence, physical assaults, things like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the ones we've gotten is oftentimes is guys that engage in some non-consensual sexual contact. And usually when you think of that, it's often you think of like a case of rape or something like that that's really coercive. And the ones that we see are not that at all. It's just some kind of assumption made that someone wants something, they don't get consent, they don't know how to talk about it. You got these young freshmen sometimes coming from rural settings and they're going to be the big man on campus and they go to a party and consume large amounts of alcohol. Mm-hmm. They meet someone at a party and then all of a sudden they proceed to try to engage sexually in it without knowing someone and things just don't turn out so well.
Yeah, I would say that's about 80% of the time when it comes to, you know, a non-consensual sex. Now, we know that the definition of sexual assault is quite broad.
Right.
I mean, sexual assault can be anything from, you know, touching someone's private area above the clothes, and it can range all the way to forcible penetration or non-consensual sex and everything in between. But for the scenario you described, I would say that's about 80% of the time. We have, you know, two college students. They go to a party. They both, you know, probably drink way too much. You know, their BAC is out of this world.
Right.
They go back to one of their, you know, places or to some place, some secluded place. They engage in sex. One person wakes up. It's the best night of their life. The other person wakes up. Oh my gosh, what did I do?
Right.
I did not want to do that. I shouldn't have did that. Why did you do this to me? And then they, you know, go and report right. to Title IX.
How would you describe kind of the old traditional views of male sexuality? You know, the guy that comes to the campus and is like, he's going to go and party and have conquests and explore his sexuality. Kind of these old views on sexuality, and then kind of contrast that with the current view around this consensual mutuality of sexuality that they run into on campus and that those collide.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think we saw a, what is it, primal instinct? You know? And I think that's what it would be, that's what the media predicts, right? When you look at movies like American Pie or right. other college setting movies, and it's, you know, the guys are getting together, they're drinking, and they're going to go in. The purpose of the night is to find out who they can hook up with.
Yeah.
Right? And that was the narrative for a very long time. And colleges and universities today are having a hard time fighting that. We have to define what consent is, you know, how to get consent and how to give consent.
Right.
And that's worked not only with males, but with women as well. But we have to change the narrative, you know, yeah. and we have to, you know, teach males to respect any person they choose to engage in sexual intercourse with.
And how much work do you guys do in, like, say, orientation to your freshman year with trying to impact that or that myth that you're going to come on campus and this is a place, you know, there's that documentary called The Hunting Grounds. Mm-hmm. You might have seen that, where I think that's an interesting metaphor, like men coming to hunt. And these are the grounds where all these women are. And then you got the, you know, fraternities to try to, you know, bring them in and corral them and stuff. And there's just that mentality sometimes that's very destructive for men to see mm-hmm. women as someone they're hunting or someone that they're having a conquest with. And how do you change that?
Yeah, so there's not much. That's going to take some years to deconstruct. On the front end, what most universities do is we have modules, you know, that students, you know, have to take. And we really, you know, we define our Title IX or sexual misconduct policies. We give them examples of what, you know, what that is, how you could, you know, what it looks like to violate that policy. And we also give them some a brief education on what consent is, how to get consent. And from there on, various offices throughout the campus do programming. And we also rely on our students quite a bit to educate the campus body on what consent is. And we find that to be extremely helpful. That peer-to-peer connection is great. I think when you have, let's say, the president of a fraternity implementing some sort of, you know, consent programming with their chapter, that's much more effective than, you know, for me to come right. in and talk to a fraternity
right.
and say, this is what consent is, and this is how you get it.
Right.
You know, so that I strongly believe in that peer-to-peer education, and most universities buy into that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Do you guys do anything that's what they consider compulsory, kind of like, because a lot of times when I go on campus, like the mm-hmm. Men in Action in Grand Valley, they brought me in to talk to the young men or people who wanted to come on campus, and so it's invitational only. And so what I found sometimes, and it's like that preaching to the choir, it's like you already got kind of the young progressive guys who already are buying into this kind of culture versus bringing me in or someone in to talk to athletic programs or something where they have some sensitivity training where it's required of them as part of their participation. Any kind of compulsory kinds of things that happen? Or?
Yeah, nothing that I'm aware of in that sense. I think most of the, you know, proactive Title IX or sexual misconduct training happens as a student, not so much, you know, when you come to the university as a student versus specific university-affiliated organizations. That would be on the, you know, that would be on the organization to bring someone in.
Right.
And maybe that's happening, maybe it's not, but it's definitely not a centralized thing. It would be up to that organization to invite a guest speaker.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, just to pivot a little bit, because you we talked about your conflict resolution and restorative justice. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of that. It's a different paradigm of way of thinking about conflict. And again, a more traditional masculine view of conflict is to conquer and overpower and dominate and get something to someone to submit so you win. Mm-hmm. And that would be a traditional trope, masculine trope. So how does this conflict resolution, what's the ethos of that? And how does that contrast what I just described? And
yeah, well, I think by defining what we call restorative practices, you know, would give us a good foundation for this conversation. So this is my definition.
Okay.
I'm sure you can Google restorative practices and get other definitions. But the way that I define it is kind of in three buckets, right? So those who are in community with each other have the opportunity to set the expectations for how that community will function. So that's the first bucket. Okay. The second bucket is those who are in community with each other have the responsibility to maintain a healthy community. And then third is what we often hear as restorative justice. You know, when harm occurs in a community, those who are impacted, those who cause the harm, they must come together to repair that harm. So if we put that into the context of a college, the college and university must work with faculty, staff, and students to create its policies and procedures, right?
Okay.
And the second bucket, administrators, faculty, staff, and students, they have to work together to maintain a healthy community where all students can thrive, all faculty can thrive, et cetera. And if there is harm on the college campus, then, you know, faculty, staff, and students should come together to repair that harm. And it's not in a traditional judicial way where you have someone who did something bad, they go before a judge, the judge hears them out, they slap them with some sanction, and they send them on their way. The problem with that is the individuals who they harmed have no say, no authority. They don't feel like the harm that was done to them has been repaired at all.
Okay.
Right, so they're more focused on the policy violation versus the actual individual who was harmed.
So yeah. Is that dovetail into the criminal justice reform?
And looking
at rehabilitation mm-hmm. of the offender, if you will, very differently.
Sure.
And then that person's relationship to the community that they harmed or the victim that they harmed.
Right, because the ultimate goal in conflict resolution or student conduct in the way that, you know, my office, you know, moves forward is we want to create an environment where the individual who caused harm can, you know, be welcomed back into the community.
Okay.
And the individuals who were harmed will be welcoming to that individual. And you can't do that through a traditional process. There's a lot of learning that comes out of this. So the individual who caused harm, they will be able to directly talk, or maybe sometimes indirectly talk to the individual they harmed, and they will learn from that. They'll grow from that. If you were to ask 10 people who were in a room and they witnessed the incident, you know, you could potentially get 10 different answers as to what happened.
Right.
You know, and by each individual hearing, you know, what happened, that will give them a different perspective and they can, you know, grow. And that leads to, you know, higher levels of satisfaction with the process and lower recidivism rates.
Right. I always say the enemy of violence is empathy.
Yeah.
If you know what you're doing mm-hmm. and the harm you're causing others, you're less likely to do it. And so the process you describe seems like it gives the offender or the assailant or whatever mm-hmm. we call that person who harmed the community or the individual, gives them a chance to hear more intimately, more personally, the harm they caused, and there's can be a lesson in that.
Yeah, and to take it a step further and using, you know, sexual assault as a scenario, you know, if someone was sexually assaulted, they may not want that person to be kicked out of the university. You know, they may not want that person to, you know, some university still fine. They may not want that person to, you know, get a fine or be expelled. Sometimes they just want the person to know that they hurt them.
Yeah.
Right. And in a traditional conduct process where the harm party is not the repairing harm of the harm party is not taken into consideration, that wound will never be healed for them. Mm. You know, and that person who committed the harm will simply just feel punished. They will never have an opportunity to apologize. They will never have an opportunity to, you know, learn how they hurt that person.
Right.
How powerful would it be for the offender to, you know, sit across the table, and when it's appropriate, we're not forcing people to do this, of course, this is all voluntary, and some people have opted into doing this. How powerful would it be for the person who was assaulted to say, "You hurt me. This is how you hurt me. This is how I perceived that night to be." And the person who caused the harm could, "Wow, I never knew I could do all that harm by what I just did. I'm so sorry." I guarantee you that experience, well, I cannot guarantee, but I would hope that that experience would change that person's life so much that they would never do that again.
Right. It's really about believing the goodness in humans. And, right. and I mean, certainly there are people that are just antisocial and kind of predatory and psychopathic, but that's a small portion of what you guys are dealing with, right. very, very small. And so the punishment model of just being mad at people for doing bad behavior and just hitting them with sanctions and punishment seems like you're saying it's not as effective this model. Do you guys have any kind of tracking this, you know, recidivism or a way to see if how effective it is and quantifying it in some way, or is it more qualitative kind of?
So both. So we are able to, based on the software that we use, we are able to see based on certain types of violations and the resolution pathway, to, whether it be formal or informal, do they have another violation during their time at the university? And we have found that students who go through informal resolution processes have less future violations than those who go through the formal process. And this is consistent with national data as well.
Right.
It has been proven time and time again. There are dissertations on it. There are research papers on it. You know, there's a higher level of engagement. There's a higher level of just empathy, learning and understanding and growth through an informal process. It takes longer, right?
Yeah.
And it costs more. You have to have more resources to do it, which is why some universities have not been able to implement it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that some people look at it and are skeptical. They think that, oh, you're going soft. You're going, you know, you're giving these people, you know, a way out, and they fear that you're going to coddle them, and then they're not going to learn from it. Then they're kind of stuck in this more punitive model that works.
Mm-hmm.
But if the outcome is public safety and the outcome is rehabilitation, then let's look at what the evidence shows.
Right. That argument, and in addition to, we're forcing people to come in contact with their offender.
Okay.
And that is not the truth. I mean, all informal resolution processes are voluntary, and all parties can opt into them and they can opt out of them at any time.
Right.
To your point, I mean, I remember being a child and you know, spankings only take you so far. My dad is old school. I used to get spanked. I know it's probably bad. He's going to be mad that I said this. But, you know, growing up, I did something wrong. I would get spanked, right?
Right.
But guess what? That was over in like a minute or two. You know, what really hurt was for him to tell me he was disappointed.
Yeah.
Right. That lasted for weeks. That disappointment in my father, for him to tell me what I did and how I either, you know, and caused damage to our home, or I embarrassed our family or something like that. And he'd tell me how disappointed he was in me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that hurt. You know, if you want to spank me, go, I will get that over with. Or, you know, those long-term punishments, take the TV away for a week, you know. So you got to have an educational component. And many times the punitive process does not offer an educational component, which... You know, you're not teaching the person how to not do that again. You're just punishing them for it.
Right. Mm-hmm. So there is definitely a transformation or evolution of how we look at dealing with these things. And you seem like you're on the forefront of that. And you hear the kickback, the concerns that it's not going to work. It's softening. It's a coddling. And so I like how you frame that for the... We did that with raising children as well. We thought that, you know, now that we got rid of corporal punishment, we can't spank kids anymore. They're all going to run the streets and burn the buildings down, right?
Yeah.
Not so much?
No, not at all, actually. The buildings are still standing, I think.
Yeah. So, say a little bit about your work in kind of the social justice or racial justice or, you know, LGBTQ work and on campus, and just that kind of that larger umbrella of a social justice movement. And
I think specifically, working with, student populations, we have to understand that our campuses are becoming more and more diverse every day. And it is probably, if you look up the mission of any university, they probably have something about diversity in it. Right. Global environment, inclusion, a space where all people can be comfortable, something like that.
Yeah.
And we have students coming from multiple or having multiple social, intersecting social identities. So we have to create, environments for them on campus where they can feel comfortable. And when it comes specifically to racial justice, our country has been, black and brown people have been under attack, forever, but it's been very, very, very visible these last few years.
Yeah.
I remember a lot of these, thinking beyond, civil rights movement in my lifetime, the murder of Mike Brown really was a trigger for a lot of activism.
Yeah.
I think that's what even kicked off the Black Lives Matter movement. And since then, a lot of these senseless killings of black men, black women, brown folks or all folks of color have been put on the forefront. And we've seen a lot of activism on campus as a result of that, which I appreciate.
Yeah,
I think the strongest voices on the campus is our students.
Yeah.
When they say jump, we as administrators oftentimes jump.
Do you have, on a macro level, we're hearing some kickback with the BLM movement and, the All Lives Matter movement, and if that's just such a movement, but of course All Lives Matter, but we're just kind of focused on this. I always kind of use this thing about, if we put a certain animal on the, extinction, list, it's because they're, we got to pay special attention. That doesn't mean we don't care about the squirrels and the bunny rabbits anymore. It's just, so that idea that All Lives Matter. Anyway, I'm just wondering if you run into students who feel attacked or marginalized or oppressed by that discussion
of Black Lives Matter?
Yeah,
just of course.
That, and how do you manage that and try to, again, in that conflict resolution spirit and creating dialogue rather than punishing it and shutting it down? But how do you try to create some kind of discernment or dialogue around some of that?
Yeah, so conflict resolution is perfect for these types of conversations. When you bring people together who have varying ideas, opposing ideas even,
right.
We bring them together, we set some ground rules. You have an extremely well-trained facilitator because, as you can imagine, these conversations can go left, really fast.
Yeah.
But you set those ground rules, and the purpose of a dialogue versus a discussion or a debate is a dialogue, you come to ask more questions than make statements. You really want to have that sense of understanding. Right. So I'm going to ask questions so that I can understand where you're coming from.
Right.
Even when we leave this space, we may not agree with each other, but at least I'll understand how our opinions fundamentally differ.
Yeah.
Right. That's the goal. And I let people know that, facilitated dialogue doesn't mean we're going to reach some sort of resolution today. We're not trying to convince you to think the way that someone else thinks. We just want you to understand their point of view. So in my opinion, the best way to educate someone who is against the Black Lives Matter movement is for them to really educate themselves on what the Black Lives Matter movement is.
Yeah.
And to your point, it's kind of foolish for someone to say all lives matter. Of course, all lives matter.
Right.
Right. But all lives aren't being killed, almost daily, by police in America and all over the country. So we're going to pay special attention to this population who needs it.
Right. Yeah. So what you think young men that, and again, we're pivoting again. You have so much knowledge that I want to tap into, wade into all of this with you in a short amount of time. So I pivot to looking at just young men coming on campus and just the stats right now, more females are graduating from college. And I don't know if you know the percentage of the gender disparity at Grand Valley, but every time I look at it, it's like, I don't know, 60-40.
We're consistent with national trends.
Yeah, 60-40. So you think about this just tremendous shift, failure to launch, young men struggling, the attrition rate, high school dropouts is greater for young men and attrition rate in college too. What do you see going on with that, and how can we help these young men? What's the struggle as you see it when it comes to, you might be saying, you're the one who's supposed to know that.
I can speculate. This isn't really my, field of study as far as like retention goes.
But I
could imagine that just the traditional kind of European education style where you sit down, I'm going to lecture to you for, you know, so many hours, and then you regurgitate the information you learned. That doesn't work for a lot of men, or for some students, period.
Right.
You know, I think there's data. Don't quote me on this, but women probably have a longer attention span than men. I mean, you might know that.
Yeah.
So for, you know, a man to be, or a male student to be in a class for 3 hours, expected to listen to a math lecture, I mean, halfway through, they're just, this isn't for me. Yeah. You know, I've had that. I mean, I'm as you shared earlier, I'm a doctoral student,
right?
And I'm in class once a month, 3 days a week, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. And wow. Due to the pandemic, is over Zoom.
Oh my!
So you can imagine. And as an adult, I think I can focus a bit longer, but you can imagine, you know, halfway through some of these lectures, I mean, my mind is on everything else that I wish I was doing. So, you know, maybe that has something to do with it.
Right.
I mean, I don't want to generalize, but I do know that some of the more hands-on, more physical occupations are dominated by men, not because women don't want to do it. It's just that men are more targeted for those opportunities.
Right. And in our efforts to get people educated and credentialed and advanced degrees, I think we've forgotten about the trades and the value of that. And so giving people options for non-traditional ways of working and learning a skill.
Yeah, that is huge. Yeah. We are building, you know, back to the college campus, we are building all these state-of-the-art buildings. When you walk in the room and snap your fingers, the lights go on, you touch the wall, the whiteboard shows up, you know, all these different things that we can do. You can speak and the computer comes on. But wow. If it breaks, we don't have anyone to fix it. You know, so yeah. We definitely need to invest into our trades. And I mean, just basic carpentry. I mean, you know, we don't have people to repair homes anymore, you know, so I think we need to get back to our trades.
Right. Do you guys still have the Men in Action at Grand Valley? Is that still happening? Or is that, because that used to be, I have a guy that did gender studies at Grand Valley that.
To my knowledge, it's no longer in existence.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it can be rejuvenated, revitalized at any moment. But and of course, the pandemic really put a hit on all of our organizations.
Right.
You know, most students are, you know, just trying to make it.
Right.
You know, and remain successful in their classes.
Right. Any other thing I was thinking about too is just, you know, we and I did that staff training with some of your counseling office. There was this discussion about trying to create some groups maybe for people to get together and talk to. Is there any groups going on of young men that can circle up and talk about their struggles or
Yeah,
challenges?
I do know that the counseling center offers those types of spaces. I'm not sure what the attendance is looking like, you know, over Zoom.
Yeah.
But we're gonna be back full fledged, you know, at Grand Valley.
That's awesome.
And I know many universities across the country are gonna be, you know, primarily in person again, those that were traditionally in person. So I would imagine those are gonna ramp up and more people are getting vaccinated, which I think is a good thing. Controversial topic, but I think it's a good thing.
so do I.
Yeah. so we'll have more people on campus and those types of activities will resume.
Yeah, I'm back in person, even though it's probably reality. You might be referring some misconduct because once you start getting people live, then there's a lot of goodness in that. But then you start seeing the dark side of that, and you're going to end up probably with the more misconduct issues, right?
Yeah, I think and something that we've been, you know, floating around is, you know, we're going to have two first-year classes. You know, so the ones who just graduated from high school and the individuals who graduated from high school but had to stay home. So now they're getting their first sense of, their first taste of freedom.
Right.
You know, they're going off to college, even as a, you know, a second year or a sophomore, but they didn't have that you know, first year freshman experience before. So now we have double the amount of students who right. are just getting that taste of freedom. Yeah. So it should be fun.
Yeah. I'm sure you're looking forward to the fall of actually having some normative college experiences with people being on campus again.
Oh, yeah. Even having like the tours walking by. Yeah. You know, just seeing people. Campus has been a ghost town. So just to even walk through our, you know, student union and just hear people. Right. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's good to have you. Next time I talk to you, at what point I'm going to have to start calling you Dr. Williams. But
you'll have to make a doctor's appointment to get me here.
But I appreciate all the work you do, and you know that ethos of trying to create spaces mm-hmm. for people to resolve problems and create healing. It's just a different way of pursuing conflict and pursuing, you know, sure. people offending and people doing things and breaking things and misconduct. And so I like that model, and I'm glad you're at the forefront of that. And I appreciate you coming in and talking about it.
Yeah, no problem. When anybody asks me what I do for a living, I tell them I maintain relationships.
Wow.
That's what it's all about. You know, if I did something to you, our relationship has been damaged.
Yeah.
And I have to do something for you to repair that. And that can be anything from, you know, breaking your laptop to something more, way more egregious, you know. So,
Well, thank you, Anthony.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Revealing Men. If you're looking for more information about counseling, coaching, and consultative services, please visit the Men's Resource Center of West Michigan online at menscenter.org. Also, feel free to contact us on our website if you have questions about this segment, ideas for a topic, or would like to be a guest on the Revealing Men podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating so others can find us. Be well and have a great day.